I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to The Midpoint with me, Gabby Logan. It's been a while since I've done an expert-only episode, and when I sat down to think about topics that you might find interesting, I suddenly realised we haven't actually done a deep dive into the menopause. Of course, a lot of my guests have compared their anecdotes. You might remember Lorraine Candy's cucumber in the airing cupboard story, and my kids tease me mercilessly for always talking about it, but I haven't sat down with an actual expert and really got into what is going on in our bodies throughout this time. So let me introduce Dr. Jen Gunter. Jen is a gynecologist and pain medicine physician, as well as a New York Times best-selling writer and the author of The Menopause Manifesto. The Guardian dubbed her the world's most famous and outspoken gynecologist, so I cannot wait to meet her. I'm going to be using The Menopause Manifesto as a starting point, but Jen has a number of other published works on female health that you might also want to check out. And you have got in touch with me as well with your own questions, so many of them, and I'm going to put as many as I can to her today. So thank you for that. Here she is then, Dr. Jen Gunter. Dr. Jen Gunter, thank you so much for coming on The Midpoint. Lovely to see you.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I have a copy, I've just mentioned in your introduction, of The Menopause Manifesto here. And I obviously have been dipping in and out of it, which is, I think, the great thing about it as well, because you cover so many areas that reflect actually how people have such different experiences. And this is the journey that women are on. And you talk on the back of the book as well about the fact that menopause isn't a disease. It's a planned change. The only thing is we've not really been planning for decades, have we? Because it's been such a taboo subject. And books like this really do help debunk that, I think. You obviously saw that this was needed in the market.
Yeah. So when I was on book tour for The Vagina Bible, the book that I wrote before, the initial questions in the audience were, all about, vaginas and vulvas. And then it seemed that that really created a space. And then question after question about menopause started to come out. And I was a little bit surprised. I didn't realize that it was such a taboo subject or that people were actually that uninformed. But it seemed that creating that safe space to talk about the vagina made people feel safe to talk about that. And I thought, okay, well, the universe is telling me something, and it's telling me I need to write about menopause.
Yeah. And you also say about puberty, and I've tried to kind of say this to people when I've been talking about this, that we would never expect teenagers to enter that period of life uninformed and unaware of what was about to happen with their bodies. But really, it's not that long ago that I think I'm 50 years old, and just a few years ago that I even heard the word perimenopause, which now seems to be very much the description of the period before your actual menopause. People didn't realize how long symptoms could last for. They didn't know how varied they were. So what I've done, Jen, is put the questions out to our wonderful community, because it's no good me just telling you, kind of my theories or my experiences rather. So they have come back, as you'd imagine, in their tens and tens of different areas and highlight really how many different issues there are around menopause. So I'm going to get cracking. And if you're okay to answer them, that would be brilliant. My brain fog and memory is really bad. I've been on HRT patches for 18 months and still no change. Have you got any advice for me, please, on this one? And we know that is one of the symptoms.
Yeah, so brain fog is absolutely a symptom of menopause, and it's something that is more worrying to people than it is medically worrisome. So it's not a sign of dementia. It's not a sign of anything like that. In fact, most women test better than they think when they're formally cognitively tested. So for many people, the perception is they're doing worse than they actually are. And in fact, in one study, women in menopause outperformed men. So not a big surprise. There's a lot of brain reorganization that happens with menopause. Your brain is always pruning pathways it doesn't need. And you have a lot of pathways in your brain that are dedicated to the menstrual cycle, and you don't need those pathways anymore. So one theory is all of this reorganization is, you know, part of that brain fog. What I would say is that brain fog can also be a symptom of other things as well. So it can be a symptom of depression. It could be a symptom of iron deficiency. It can be a symptom of sleeping poorly for other reasons. And so, you know, if this is something that is persistent, that I would recommend seeing a healthcare provider about. Estrogen doesn't treat brain fog in general. It's not, and so this experience is not uncommon. Now, if brain fog is due to hot flashes that are keeping you up at night and you're sleeping poorly, then it might treat it, but it's not, brain fog's not really the problem. It's poor sleep is the problem, right? So if somebody tells me they're sleeping well, then you need to either look for other causes like depression or iron deficiency or, you know, sleep apnea, other types of things, and then understand that it's usually something that goes away. Now, if somebody feels really cognitively impaired, then they may very well need to have, you know, memory testing and everything else, make sure something else isn't going on. And there are some women who do well with some of the ADHD medications for really severe brain fog, because estrogen does have an impact on executive functioning, which is kind of like planning and organizing and that type of thing. And so it doesn't respond though to estrogen. Not everything that's, you know, that is associated with low estrogen is actually reversed by giving estrogen, right? So the low estrogen could be a marker for something else going on. So for somebody who's having persistent memory issues, there'd be a time to, you know, talk to the doctor, rule out other causes. And if it's really persistent and worrisome, then there may be a role to try one of those medications. Also, sometimes when people are reassured that it's not, you know, something else, that also can help make them feel better.
Yeah. And as you said at the beginning, to do with sleep, as other stress issues that might come from the symptoms can lead to memory issues, can't they? So,
and one thing that I would add is that a lot of women in midlife are carrying an incredible load. And so if you have, for example, two kids that you're trying to get ready for college and you've got financial difficulties and you have to work full time and you're the person also doing the grocery shopping and doing all these other things, you know, a human can only do so many things. And so, you know, it's also important just to see, like, what is the load that I'm carrying? Am I carrying a reasonable load or am I carrying an unreasonable load, right? And to see if it's an unreasonable load, you know, to see if there's a way to sort of make that load a little bit more reasonable. I mean, I know myself at any age of my life, you know, when I have been completely overworked handling multiple different tasks, you know, sometimes you drop some balls. So it's just unfortunate that a lot of women, because they end up doing, especially in heterosexual relationships, they end up doing the bulk of the emotional labor in the relationship. At workplaces, they're doing the bulk of the emotional labor. They may be carrying a lot more weight than somebody else too.
Okay. There's quite a few questions that relate to this next area. I have a regular and varied exercise regime and a healthy diet, but the weight keeps piling on. Why? And a similar one was, why is it so much harder to lose weight in this period of life?
So weight gain that happens sort of during the menopause transition and afterwards is actually not related to hormones. So your metabolism doesn't change in menopause. The big change in metabolism happens around age 60. And that happens for both women and men around age 60. So they did a study, the study of women's health across the nation in America. They were following people from age 42 when they entered into the study and you know, checking them every year, multiple times a year, measuring weight, measuring hormones, measuring all different kinds of things. And what they found was the weight gain trajectory didn't change when people started hormonally going through menopause, right? So if it was menopause related, the trajectory would change and the trajectory remained stable. And so it's age-related weight gain, not menopause-related weight gain. And sometimes that makes people really angry. And I'm not sure I understand why. Why would it be good to be menopause and bad to be age? I don't understand that. Why is one anger-inducing and the other one isn't? But I've had people get really angry with me about it. And I'm like, I'm not saying you're not gaining weight. What I'm saying is it's age-related.
Not your hormones.
Right. And isn't that good? That means that there isn't something that is impossible to reverse. And, you know, the theory is, you know, that we all unfortunately move less as we age. If people are, you know, feeling unwell, having a lot more hot flashes, you know, sleeping poorly can absolutely affect, you know, a lot of people overeat when they're tired. I certainly overeat when I'm tired. It's harder to go to the gym. It's harder to do the things that you normally do when you don't feel like yourself. So I'm not saying that the things that happen with menopause aren't making it harder, but I'm saying that the actual weight itself is related to that, which also means then the way we lose it is the same. And again, if you don't feel well, it might be harder to get yourself into a mm-hmm. calorie deficit. If you don't feel well, it might be harder to go to the gym. So, you know,
it's eat less, move more, as it is through any age of life.
Well, it's mostly calories. So exercise is a very inefficient way to lose weight. It's a great form for weight maintenance. And it's also super important for health. So if you're talking about heart health, bone health, brain health, exercise is good for all of those things. Exercise is so good for your body. If it was a drug, everybody would want to take it. So people shouldn't say, well, I'm not losing weight, so that's why I don't want to exercise. Exercise is going to be very, very good for your heart health, your longevity, for everything. And so I would just say to women that focusing on exercise, super important for your health. Now, one thing that does happen in the menopause transition, which is hormone related, is the weight that you gain is more likely to go around the middle. So you may notice that your waist is getting larger. And I think that what gives a lot of people a perception that they're gaining more weight than they are, right? So if you have, you know, say you're putting on 5 pounds every 3 years in your life, right? If all of it, instead of those 5 pounds being distributed kind of equally around your body, it's now primarily going to one spot, you're going to feel your body shape is going to change and you're feel a lot different. And I think that's why people sometimes are like, well, wait a minute, my body's different. And yes, it absolutely is. And we think that there are hormonal drivers to that, but we don't really understand why. There are some theories that might be linked to the levels of FSH, which is called follicle stimulating hormone, which rises in menopause. But the truth is we don't actually understand. And that weight that we put around the middle is more harmful to us. So that's metabolically active fat. And that's the fat that's associated with inflammation and heart disease and type 2 diabetes. And that's one of the theories why there's an increased risk of type 2 diabetes during the menopause transition to menopause is related to that increased risk of metabolic syndrome. So it is super important to be mindful of it, but also to understand that losing weight can be very, very difficult. And, you know, it's important to focus on health. And I say people, you know, you want to have 25 grams of fiber a day. You want to focus on fish protein and plant-based protein if you can, trying having lots of vegetables and, you know, reduce your high-fat dairy and reduce your butter, that type of thing, and focus on the exercise.
Should women who become menopausal due to surgery do anything differently to women who experience it naturally? There were quite a few questions that were similar to this, and it's a really important area to discuss, I think.
So not really. So it's really more the age at which it happens. And in general, you know, if you have your ovaries out when you're 72, you're unlikely to notice a change, right? Now, if you have your ovaries out when you're 42 because of, you know, and we really try to avoid doing that. But there are people who have them removed, say, for example, to reduce the risk of ovarian cancer. There's people at high mm-hmm. risk, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they've decided, I want to have my ovaries removed. I want to reduce my risk. Totally, absolutely understandable and supported medical decision. So because in that situation, people are going to have a more rapid drop in hormones as opposed to, you know, kind of a slower stop even over a couple of months. Symptoms can be much more severe, but we want to get people started on therapy basically the day they have their surgery. Now, if you're 42 and your ovaries stop working just because they stop working at 42, we're still going to recommend hormone therapy because we recommend it when anybody goes through menopause under the age of 45. So that's why, I mean, it's not really any different because we're still, you know, whether you're 38 and it's a surgical menopause, whether you're 38 and it's primary ovarian insufficiency, we're still going to recommend hormones. Now, between the ages of 45 and older, you know, if you have your ovaries out again before menopause, so say you're 47 and you're having out because maybe you had they were worried about cancer, they removed your ovaries, it's not cancer, but now you don't have your ovaries. So in general, you know, the symptoms tend to also be a little bit worse. So many people would talk about, hey, you know, do you want to try starting some hormones? And then we can kind of gradually wean you down and you can decide if you want to be on them or not, you know, to kind of give you a more gradual step down than you would normally have. And that's kind of an individual discussion with your provider.
You just touched on it there. And this next question, I think, relates to something you said. I had a full abdominal hysterectomy at 30 due to my BRCA1 genetic history. Due to the cancer history in my family, I can't take HRT. I'm worried about bone health. I walk, I cycle, I do yoga, I ditch the booze, I never smoked. I'm now 21 years post-surgery at 50 years old, wondering if there's anything else I can do to help my bone health. And this relates to a lot of people who ask questions about not being able to take hormones.
Yeah. So the first thing, for someone who had their ovaries removed that early, we would recommend that they have a bone density test to see where their bone density is. And actually, we'd recommend that they have it, you know, kind of within a year of having their ovaries out and then have it followed, you know, depending on how often based on what their levels are. So that person should absolutely have a bone density test so we know where they are. If they're have good bone health and they don't have any evidence of, you know, osteopenia, there's no bone loss or in really good shape, then what they're doing might well be okay. Not everybody is going to get osteoporosis. I think it's an important thing to remember, although having your ovaries out early is certainly a risk factor. There are non-hormonal medications to preserve bone mass, and an endocrinologist is generally the person who prescribes that. And we would generally prescribe it based on the results of the bone density score. So that would be why that would be really important to have. And there's also a score called a FRAX score. It's actually from the University of Sheffield. And so you can just Google FRAX and it will come up, F-R-A-X, and you can put in your data and it'll also give you a risk for osteoporosis. It's a little less accurate without your bone density, but it gives you a starting point with your doctor. But regardless, anybody who goes through menopause before the age of 40 needs to have a bone density. So, you know, kind of at baseline.
Okay. And then other people who can't take HRT because of that, she's specifically worried about her bone health. But mm-hmm. other people are worried about other things happening in menopause and they can't take HRT because of cancer or risk of cancer in the family. What else can people do? Or is it specific to the areas they're worried about?
It's really specific to the areas. And I think it's important for people to understand that we don't currently recommend menopausal hormone therapy as preventative therapy for anything else except osteoporosis. So the current recommendation isn't to say every woman should be on it for heart health. The current recommendation isn't to say every woman should be on it to prevent dementia. Those aren't the current recommendations. And I hear a lot from women, you know, maybe women who have breast cancer, that they fear that they're missing out because of the way this is being presented on social media. And you know, if those were the guidelines, it would be really obvious that, you know, you could go to the British Menopause Society and it would all be written there. You could go to the International Menopause Society. And so I would tell people that, you know, still the single most important thing for, you know, taking care of your body is eating a healthy diet, not smoking, and exercising. Those are more powerful than anything else, you know, basically that you can do. And those are the important foundation. And in one study where they were looking at risk factors for heart health, it was actually a study of women on hormone therapy, they found that only 8% of women were getting the required amount of exercise, eating a healthy diet, and not smoking. 8%. So there's a lot of room to do a lot of things. And so I think it's just important for people to know. But so somebody who can't take hormones, there are non-hormonal medications for hot flashes. So there's the neurokinin 3 antagonists, which one has been approved. And there's another one that's in phase 3
trials. What's that, say that again?
The neurokinin 3 antagonists. So those are Vizoa is the trade name in the US. I'm not sure what the trade name is in the UK, but it's one of the newer medications that was just approved. Gabapentin, which is a medication we use for nerve pain, can be quite effective for hot flashes. The antidepressant venlafaxine can be quite effective. There's a medication called oxybutynin that can be effective. So there are other medications to try. So I think that's an important thing for people to know.
And what about supplements as well that could boost estrogen? Is there anything natural?
No, those are basically all a scam. So you can't change your estrogen level with a supplement. It's not possible to do. And the data from phytoestrogens are very poor. The data is not good at all. So, I mean, people are free to take it, but the North American Menopause Society reviewed all the data for all the non-hormonal options for just recently, and they had guidelines published last year, and not one supplement passed the threshold of being recommended. And these medications are quite expensive. I think that's important for people to understand. And in many cases, while they're all unregulated, certainly in the United States, you don't really know what's in a lot of them. So I would say that no, there isn't a supplement that I would recommend.
Okay. If you don't have, this is a question, obviously, if you don't have major menopause symptoms, should you just leave it well alone? I'm assuming what they mean is, should you just leave HRT and hormone replacement well alone?
Well, you know, obviously, you know, this is an individual medical advice, and it's up to an individual person with their own healthcare providers who know them the best. But there isn't a universal recommendation to recommend menopausal hormone therapy for all women. So, you know, there are people who do great without it. There are people who feel terrible on it, who can't take it. You know, I have a very good friend who had terrible symptoms in menopause. She had every symptom except hot flashes. And hormones made every single symptom worse. She tried them for 3 years and she ended up going on an antidepressant that treated her symptoms much better. She's off that now and she's doing great. The only symptom I had was hot flashes, you know, so people can have such a different experience. I went on hormones because my hot flashes were really bad, but also I have a very, very high risk of osteoporosis. That's actually what my mother died from, was osteoporosis. So, you know, you have to look at your different individual risk factors, and that's personalized medicine, is deciding, you know, what's best for you based on who's most likely to have a benefit.
Does alcohol make it worse? And if so, why?
Yeah, nobody likes the answer to this either. So first, yeah, a lot of people describe alcohol making their hot flashes worse. Certainly for me, I can't drink red wine anymore. If I have like a glass of red wine, I sleep through my hot flashes. I wake up my husband. So he's like, you can't have any more red wine. So there's that. So yeah, they can. Alcohol also contributes to weight gain. It's not good for your bone health.
Not good for
heart health, not good for sleep. And it's a carcinogen. You know, everybody always talks about, you know, their, you know, concerns about breast cancer and should I take hormones because of that? And it's a whole different discussion, but alcohol is a carcinogen and it is associated with breast cancer. So that's just important for people to understand too. And, you know, I'm not saying don't ever have a drink, but, you know, I have to say that for me, you know, I maybe have 2 glasses of alcohol a month now. I mean, that would be it. And, you know, I think that it's just something, you know, for people to think
about.
Why
does it, is it the sugar in alcohol? What is it that makes it worse?
Well, I mean, the alcohol itself is carcinogenic. I don't know from a hot flashes standpoint, I don't think we really know. It's, you know, it messes with your brain chemistry and that's where it all happens, right? That's where the hot flash starts in your brain. It affects sleep. So, you know, probably, and from a weight gain standpoint, it's, you know, absolutely the empty calories, right?
Mm-hmm. Can talking therapy help in the menopause?
Yeah, well, so it depends how you define it. So cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a very specific type of psychotherapy, can actually be effective for hot flashes. It really can. And it also, there's a very special kind of cognitive behavioral therapy called CBTI, which is for insomnia. And it's very effective for insomnia. So if I have somebody in my office who was sleeping really poorly and having a lot of hot flashes, and we start her on estrogen and she's still sleeping poorly, but not waking up with hot flashes, you know, I'm saying let's start exploring CBTI because it's more effective than sleeping medication for sleep issues. So that's just something for people to understand. So yeah, it gets a bad rap, but you know, that is the ultimate mind-body medicine. Everybody talks that they want mind-body medicine. And, you know, there was a kerfuffle on Instagram when the NICE guidelines came out and they were talking about cognitive behavioral therapy. And there was some doctors talking about like that was insulting to women. And I'm like, well, if there's evidence-based medicine to support it, how is that insulting? I mean, it's mind-body medicine. Isn't that something that we're all supposed to want to embrace? And so, yeah, I mean, some people are very helped by it. And I just think it's good to have options. Not everybody wants to take a medication and not everybody can.
Do fibroids affect menopause symptoms, says this lovely lady here. And can you explain what fibroids are?
Yeah, so fibroids are benign tumors of the uterus and they're not cancer. They can be completely asymptomatic. People can have really large fibroids and have no symptoms, and they can have really small ones and have a lot of symptoms. And it's probably because some of them are more inflammatory than others. We don't really understand why. So fibroids don't really get worse in the menopause transition. They grow kind of based on age. So if you look at the number of fibroids people have when they're 20, you know, by the time, you know, women are in their late 40s, about 70% of white women and 80% of black women will have fibroids. So they're probably the result of the way the uterus has been designed to kind of repair itself after injury. And that injury repair mechanism starts to get funky as you get older, right? And so, you know, it's probably reflecting kind of the limits of the uterus, if you will. So menopause itself, meaning like the hormonal changes of the menopause transition, they don't actually make fibroids grow, probably more just kind of age related. I mean, it's possible they do, but it's, you know, it's hard. You can't really separate that out. But what happens is bleeding issues are common in the menopause transition, right? So people have irregular periods or they have heavy periods. And if you have fibroids on top of that, this can make your periods heavier. Fibroids can make your periods hurt more. So it can certainly make the bleeding symptoms that you're having worse. So now you're not dealing just with menopause-related bleeding issues, but you're also dealing with fibroid-related bleeding issues. So now you got two things going on. Now, the good news is after menopause, fibroids tend to shrink and they stop becoming problematic. So once they're sort of starved of estrogen, if you will, they start to shrink. So, you know, if you notice, if you're having heavy periods, it's absolutely worthwhile getting checked out to make sure they're not too heavy, to make sure there isn't something else causing them like fibroids. Because sometimes people say, oh, it's just menopause. And then we find out they've got a 10-centimeter fibroid tumor. So important to get that checked out.
Why are my boobs enormous and painful?
I don't know if I have an answer. I think that certainly for some people, hormonal fluctuations can cause breast pain. For some people, it's more the levels. For some people, it's the fluctuation. And especially if you're in the later menopause transition and maybe you're going a couple of months without ovulating, and so you're finally having a reduction in hormones, and then all of a sudden, you ovulate again. And what some people don't know is that in the menopause transition, sometimes your estrogen levels can be much higher than they normally are. So you can have basically a double ovulation. And so the net result is you have higher levels of estrogen. And so that could also produce breast pain.
So we don't know what stage this lady is, whether she's perimenopausal, menopausal. Yeah. So that could potentially be a reason.
Yeah. But also any changes in your breast, definitely worth discussing with your doctor, making sure your breast cancer screening is up to date and such.
Okay. This is, I think, a really impossible question really to answer, but how do we know what is normal or abnormal?
All symptoms are normal in the sense that they're all part of menopause. It's whether or not they sort of broach the level that they're interfering with your, you know, activities of daily living, the quality of life. So in the same way, when you went through puberty, right, you may have had some emotional times, you may have had acne, right? All of those things are normal as part of the puberty experience, but it doesn't necessarily mean you have to put up with them, right? So, you know, I would say the normal things to expect are irregular periods in the menopause transition. A lot of people get hot flashes. Not everybody's bothered by them. Some people can get depression. Some people can get joint pain. Some people can notice weight gain around the middle, as we talked about. So there's many different symptoms that people have. And people notice their skin gets drier. And, you know, some of those things are manageable. Sometimes those things might be enough that they affect your quality of life and you need to seek care.
And I'm 41. Should I expect the next 15 years to be hideous? Are there any silver linings? Which sounds quite depressing, doesn't it? That person's kind of take on what they're hearing about the menopause is so bad. But give some reasons to be cheerful.
Yeah. So after menopause, women are generally happier. They generally are. Now, I don't know if it's because they just don't care about, you know, they're free of society. You're free of the male gaze, you know, free of all those expectations. Or if it's the fact that now that all that reproductive stuff is cleared out from your brain, you've got okay, I got all this space now. I'm going to do stuff with it. Or it's the fact that you're a little bit more conscious of where you are on the timeline and you're like, I got to do some more things. So it could be different things for different people. It could be that your kids are out of the house and you're like, whoa, now I could travel, all different kinds of reasons. So I would say that people have been going through menopause since the beginning of time. And I think that it's only really been doom and gloom, you know, very recently because of social media, which is really a very narrow band into the experience. You have to remember that people who are doing well don't tend to post about their, hey, my day is regular. I had a regular same day that I had yesterday. You know, yeah. I mean, I'll give my own experience. The only symptom I had was hot flashes. That's it. And they weren't great. And medicine took care of it. And I was the fittest I've ever been in my life during my late menopause transition because I decided I was going to, you know, do all the things you were supposed to do. I was running half marathons. I was lifting weights, and I felt really great. I was going out dancing. I was doing all kinds of great things. And then when I never had to worry about getting pregnant again, that was awesome. Never having to travel and pack menstrual products, awesome. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so I think that embracing the change is I think a good motto. And then if you need an assist from medicine along the way, that's great. Just if you needed an assist from medicine during pregnancy, right? Some people are able to go into labor on their own and they have an easy delivery and other people need to have a C-section. So, you know, keep in mind that same flexibility that you see with pregnancy.
Yeah, it's interesting. I kind of found myself part of this conversation by accident when I started the midpoint because we didn't this wasn't a menopause podcast. You know, this was about people in midlife doing different things, men and women. And it was the women, the female guests who are well-known people who started to bring up their menopause and their symptoms. And that's when I was kind of alerted to the fact that I might even be perimenopausal myself, right? So then I found out I was and talked a little bit about that. I didn't have terrible symptoms at all. And I realized, you know, I was kind of very fortunate in that respect. And I think it's really great that it's an open conversation. But as you've just alluded to there, what you don't want is for people thinking that, you know, there's this thing that's been kept secret all these years that's awful and that women are having this terrible, terrible time. And this is hopefully a positive thing that it's out in the open and people are talking about it. And actually, this next question, I think, is a really good one because it kind of comes at things a little bit earlier. Can women in their 30s prep for menopause? And what can you do to give yourself the best run up to it? And I think stuff that you've said already about health and well-being is the best advice that you could give anybody.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're a smoker, quit now. That would be like the number one thing to do. Like number one thing to do. Invest in exercise, especially strength training. So as we age, we lose muscle mass and we tend to lose a little bit more muscle mass in menopause. But that can be slowed or even halted with resistance training. And, you know, certainly in the era that I grew up, women didn't go to gyms. Women didn't lift weights. That just like you went to aerobics classes. That was what women did. And now it's different. And I would say that if you're in your 30s and you're saying, what can I do for menopause? Get into resistance training. That way it's good for your brain. It's actually good for your heart, just as aerobic exercise is. It's good for your balance. It's good for your muscles. It helps you build bone. All these things that people are like, oh my gosh, do I need to take estrogen for preventative therapy, all this kind of stuff. That's preventative therapy right there, resistance training. And so I would say that that's the number one thing. And the number two thing would be, you know, how can I invest in a heart healthy diet? Because a heart healthy diet is the diet that's best for your body, whether, you know, you're in menopause or not. And really thinking about those kinds of, you know, that's building up your resistance, if you will. So your tank is fuller than when menopause comes. Now, that doesn't mean it's not a guarantee that you're not going to have symptoms. It's not a guarantee that you're not going to get osteoporosis, but it's going to put you in a far better stead. So that would be the thing that I would suggest.
Yeah. And while you're in your 30s and you haven't got those other life things we were talking about, you know, you're not that kind of sandwich generation where you're worrying about right. older parents and you're worrying about, you know, teenagers leaving school and all that kind of thing, then you have a bit more headspace maybe at that point as well to focus on those things. So don't waste your 30s, chicks. It's a good time to get yourself in a great place ready for what I think is a brilliant period of life. And I'm really enjoying it.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now, these are specific questions if you've got a few more minutes for me on HRT. How do you know if you're on the right HRT for you? Because my symptoms are still lurking.
Well, so it would depend on what your symptoms are and what form of menopausal hormone therapy you're on. So, for example, if someone was started on menopausal hormone therapy thinking it's going to make their brain fog go away and they don't have any of the menopause-related reasons to have brain fog, well, I'm not surprised it's not helping. However, if you were put on it for hot flashes and you're only on, say, a 25 microgram patch, that might not be enough for your hot flashes. So Also, some people start it for joint pain. Well, you know what? It's not that great for treating joint pain. It can help for some people, but it doesn't treat it for everybody. So, you know, you might be one of those people who it doesn't work for. You might be on an appropriate dose and it just doesn't work for you. So that's a really, it's important to think, okay, what is the thing that I'm hoping hormones can treat? And then am I on the dose that it could treat that? And actually, I have a blog called The Vagenda with a J, vagenda.com. And I have a big hormone therapy guide on there. And you can go through and look at like the different reasons. And, you know, there's all these what we call yellow light reasons, meaning there's some data to show that hormones can help, but it's not definitive. So if you're in one of those categories, well, then you were the person who it didn't help.
Lots of questions around this. How long basically can you keep taking it for? This question says, when should you aim to stop taking HRT, or should you just keep taking it forever? How do we know?
Well, we don't actually have an answer to that. We don't have any long-term studies where people have taken hormones for 20 or 30 years and then compared it to people who haven't. Those would have to be randomized studies for us to be able to say, right? Because taking hormones could also be associated with having more money, which might then mean that you may have, you know, a greater advantage health-wise from that reason. Or people who are more worried about their bone health might be more likely to go on hormones, and then they might be more likely to exercise and do the other things for bone health. So we don't have the answer. So I would say you have to look at your individual risk-benefit profile. Some people who feel fantastic on hormones and they don't want to go off, then I would say, let's calculate your breast cancer risk. There are calculators that we can use. Some people are at higher risk than others. And if you're in the, you know, a lower end of that risk scale and you feel good on the hormones, let's make sure you're on an appropriate long-term dose. Because often I see people who are like in their late 50s, early 60s, and they're on doses that we give women who are 40. And you don't need the same dose to treat symptoms in your late 50s that you needed in your 40s. So I would say, hey, can we get you down to kind of a more appropriate long-term dose? Because the dose we give someone who's 40 is the same dose of estrogen your ovaries are making when you're 30. You don't need that dose of estrogen when you're 60, right? So I would say, hey, can we get you down to a more reasonable dose? And then in that situation, I'd say, you know, if you don't want to stop, there's no evidence to say you must or that you should, but, you know, it's a personal decision. If somebody's at high risk for osteoporosis, then we wouldn't want them to stop because their risk of osteoporosis would come back. And then there's people who say, look, I was really just taking it for hot flashes. And since there's no convincing evidence for anything else, I'm like 8 years out from my hot flashes and I want to see if I still need the hormones. So I would say there's, you know, many different pathways to take.
So it is still very much such a personal journey, isn't it? And especially if you're taking gels, you know, it's easy to control taking more or less because you might try one pump or you might try two pumps. So it's very individual, isn't it? This journey in terms of how much and how long.
Well, you want to make sure that you're not like going up and down on your doses. You want to be on.
I don't mean like daily, but I mean for a period of time. So you say you go 4 or 5 months and you feel I've not really, obviously with the advice of your doctor, the beauty is you can tweak things slightly, can't you?
Yeah, you can, absolutely. So, you know, we have a general kind of starting dose for people who are younger, a general starting dose for people who are maybe kind of closer to their age of menopause. And we kind of have a dose that we know we really shouldn't be going over. And if you're needing more than that, then it's probably, hormones are probably not the answer, right? So, and we really have good data about what people need because we have studies with women who've had primary ovarian insufficiency, something we used to call premature menopause. And we know because we recommend giving hormones to these women, you know, we have studies and we know like what dose they need. So the idea that a woman who's 55 would need more than a woman who's 35 doesn't really kind of fit with what we know about the biology. And unfortunately, I sometimes see people who are on these mega high doses because they keep thinking that, you know, more is better and they just keep increasing and increasing and increasing. And that's not the case. I mean, you know, somebody told me the other day about a patient who was taking a dose of estrogen that, you know, would be like what was in the birth control pill. And, you know, there's like, you know, that's not a dose that you need in your mid 50s. So, you know, it just all needs to be individualized and, you know, kind of, you know, done within reason.
Yeah. And obviously having regular communication, if you can, with the person that's prescribed it. And
exactly.
Monitoring your own symptoms and how you feel is so important, isn't it? Just one question on HRT and skin. Progesterone gives me terrible spots and makes me want to stop taking it. Have you got any advice?
So there is a progestin IUD, the Mirena, that's one option. It's got a lower, you know, it's something that, you know, produces a lower level of hormones in the blood. So that's kind of one option. The other option is going with a non-hormonal route, but you can't take estrogen without a progesterone or progestin. Otherwise you will get, you know, uterine cancer eventually. There is a drug called Duavy, which is oral estrogen combined with a selective estrogen receptor modulator called basodoxifene. And so that is a way to take a medication to protect your uterus that doesn't have progesterone or progestin. So that's also another option. And finally, depending on the degree of acne, there is great evidence-based medicine for acne. So there's a topical drug called Retin-A, which people can use for acne. I've been using it since I was 28 for acne because I've got an acne problem. And it's also the only evidence-based medicine that reduces wrinkles too, or the most evidence-based topical. So that's just an added, you know, if that's of interest, that's an added bonus. So, you know, a lot of people say, well, look, I don't want to add in another medicine. But, you know, on the other hand—
And that word is, what does Retin-A come in?
It's a topical cream.
Right.
Yeah. And then there's benzoyl peroxide and other over-the-counter washes. And, you know, talking to your doctor about other treatments for acne, because someone might find it easier to start a topical medication for acne than to switch to an IUD.
But do you recognize that question? Is that something that's common for you hear about progesterone leading to breakouts?
Not typically, but everybody's different. You know, people also can get acne because of menopause. So it's hard to know without seeing an individual sort of tracking and things over time. And so as your estrogen levels drop, what happens is you basically have a greater impact of testosterone on the hair follicles. So, you know, you would want to say, well, how has this been happening along the trajectory? So, but progesterone or progestin or basodoxifene is essential to protect your uterus if you're going to be on estrogen.
A question which hasn't really come up, which I'm surprised about actually, is, and maybe it's because by the time people get to menopause, they've kind of forgotten a bit about how their cycles affected things. But is there any link with how your periods have been through your life to how your menopause will be? I've read a few things that kind of intimate that if you've had really tough periods with really, really hard symptoms, that you are more likely to have tough menopause symptoms.
No, I'm not actually aware of any data that really supports that. So in fact,
so it's anecdotal.
I would say a lot of people who have terrible periods are thrilled with menopause because they don't have those terrible symptoms anymore.
So they get rid of those, yeah.
Yeah, the happiest people in menopause tend to be the people who had terrible PMS because they're like, oh my God, now I actually have a stable level of hormones. I can't believe it. Now, it's true that they might suffer more during the menopause transition because they're having kind of more ups and downs for their PMS. But once they get through, it's sort of like, oh my gosh.
Wow.
So, you know, where people who've had super heavy periods, I mean, if you have a period that lasts 8 days and for 3 of the days it's super heavy and now you don't have any bleeding at all, like, you know, so I think it's really individual.
And polycystic ovaries as well, presumably when you get through menopause, that will improve.
Yeah, so polycystic ovarian syndrome is interesting. That is actually one of the conditions that's associated with a later age of onset of menopause. And we don't really understand why. We don't understand a lot of the biology behind polycystic ovarian syndrome. I'm not aware of any data that says that their menopause is worse, but certainly the insulin resistance and some of the other issues of polycystic ovarian syndrome can absolutely persist into menopause. And I think especially because the risk of type 2 diabetes can start to increase during the menopause transition, and women who have polycystic ovarian syndrome are at a baseline increased risk of type 2 diabetes, it's super important for them to make sure that they're getting screened appropriately for type 2 diabetes.
Wow, there's so much to digest there. You've been absolutely brilliant and given answers, thorough answers to every single question I've thrown at you there. And as you said earlier on, it is all here in the Menopause Manifesto. So thank you so, so much for sharing your knowledge, Jen.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
My biggest thanks to Dr. Jen Gunter. I really hope that this episode has been helpful to you. So please leave a review if it has. I love to read your feedback. And if you scroll back through our archive, you'll find other conversations which touch on the menopause. I remember a really entertaining one with Penny Lancaster, for example. And of course, the special compilation episode, which we entitled The Menopause. Thanks for lending me your ears for the last hour, and thanks to Spiritland Creative for putting this episode together. I hope you can join me again next week when I'll be back with a celebrity guest talking all things midlife. I'll catch you then.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.